Welcome to New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust. Today, I'm going to do something new for me. I'm going to play with top 10 lists. Usually, these things are just like instant crappy journalism. It's what you get when they don't want to clutter your mind with stories that might lead you to question the ethics of your corporate masters, or the wisdom of their servants in Congress, or the truth of everything Obama said on the campaign trail. So they feed you stories like the year's 10 biggest fashion blunders, the 10 greatest dunk shots last year in basketball. That's a real video. The top 10 foods that will make you thinner, younger, healthier, and bustier. The top 10 liposuction surgeons. And so on. There's some late-night TV host that apparently does a top 10 shtick. I forget his name. Johnny Carson? Is Johnny Carson still on? Anyway, I usually give top 10 anything a wide berth, but I recently came across a couple articles in this vein that were actually very good. One was the top 10 important news stories of the past decade that got completely ignored by the mainstream press. Number 10 was that Al Gore won the 2000 election. And of course, as the piece went on, the atrocities described got more horrific. We'll get to that today if there's time. Let's start with a similar but shorter piece by David Sirota, published New Year's Day by Common Dreams online, www.commondreams.org. I'm feeling eclectic today, so after Sirota's political, economic, social jeremiad, we'll also hear about the top 10 reasons to visit New Zealand, according to the Kiwi Prime Minister himself, the top 10 sex scandals by high government officials, the top 10 combat rifles, this one you gotta hear. But let's get back to David Sirota. His piece is titled, A Decade's Top 10 Quotations. Sirota begins, let's take a moment to look back at the top 10 quotations from the last 10 years, the ones telling us some painful truths about our country, society, and worldview, the ones that might inform us of what we need to do as we move forward. Number 10. They frankly own the place. That was Sir Richard Durbin of Illinois in 2009, describing the bank's influence in Congress. Number 9. Haven't we already given money to rich people? Shouldn't we be giving money to the middle? President George W. Bush in November 2002, acknowledging to advisers that he knew his tax cuts were giveaways to the super wealthy. Quotation number 8. Keep your government hands off my Medicare. Anti-healthcare protester at an August 2009 congressional town hall meeting in South Carolina. The single most succinct sign that our country has become an idiocracy. Number 7. We did this for the show. Falcon Heen on October 15, 2009, telling CNN that the balloon boy chase was a hoax. The declaration demonstrated that the media's 24/7 knee-jerk sensationalism is irresponsible and proved that America's culture of celebrity aspiration is completely out of control. Quotation of the decade number 6. As we know, there are known knowns. There are things we know. We also know that there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns, the ones we don't know we don't know. That was who else but Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld on February 12, 2002, effectively telling us that the government had no idea what it was doing by invading Iraq. Quote of the decade number 5.
Bring 'em on!
President George W. Bush on July 2, 2003, daring Al-Qaeda to attack U.S. troops. Yet more proof that the elite defines toughness as politicians flippantly sacrificing young American lives for Washington's hubristic ideologies. Number 4. The investment community feels very put upon. They feel there is no reason why they shouldn't earn $1 million to $200 million a year, and they don't want to be held responsible for the global financial meltdown. That was Daniel Fass, chairman of President Barack Obama's financial industry fundraising party, on October 19, 2009. Daniel Fass insisting that despite wrecking the economy and then being handed trillions of bailout dollars, Wall Street is a victim. Number 3. $500,000 is not a lot of money, particularly if there is no bonus. That was Wall Street compensation consultant James Rada on February 3, 2009, giving the New York Times a good example of just how totally out of touch the super rich really are. Quotation of the decade number two. I didn't campaign on the public option. President Obama, on December 22, 2009, expecting the public to forget that his presidential campaign platform explicitly promised to pass health care legislation giving all Americans, quote, the opportunity to enroll in a new public plan, unquote. And now the number one quotation of the decade. Fanfare, please.
And there goes the winner!
It doesn't matter. Vice President Dick Cheney, on November 5, 2006, referring to polls repeatedly showing the majority of Americans oppose the Iraq War. It doesn't matter, a sign that the ruling class truly does not care about the demands of the public. Sirota concludes, these epigrams expose a nation that has internalized and accepted the forces of avarice, corruption, dishonesty, incompetence, and insensitivity. Some of the quotes are darkly funny. Some of them are gut-wrenchingly sad. But all of them are warnings. Whether we listen to them or not will be the difference between repeating the last decade's folly or learning from it. To which I'm sure that all of us, even the atheists, will reply, Amen. Now to move from tragedy to farce, here is a recording of John Key, the Prime Minister, identifying the top 10 reasons to spend your bonus check on a trip visiting scenic New Zealand.
Here to present tonight's top 10 list, please welcome New Zealand Prime Minister John Key, ladies and gentlemen. John Key. The category, top 10 reasons you should visit New Zealand.
Oh, well, that makes sense.
All right, here we go. Number 10.
The Auckland Airport now has a Cinnabon.
Cinnabon.
Well, there's a reason.
Number 9.
We have the loosest slot machines in the Pacific Rim.
There's a reason.
How about that?
Number 8.
Only a convenient 20-hour flight away.
Do you get mail down there?
Oh, sure, yeah. By pigeon.
Number 7.
It's like England without the attitude.
Number 6.
You like this, Dave? Down there, Leno's on at 9 o'clock.
What?
What?
Leno's on.
Wait a minute.
Leno's on at 9 o'clock. That's okay.
Number 5.
Get the funno together, stay in a batch, crack open the chili bin, and slap on your jandals.
That's that New Zealand. That's Zealand speak.
Number 4.
Visit in the next 30 days. I'll pick you up at the airport.
Wow, that's darn nice. That's darn nice. Number 3.
70% of our energy is generated through renewable hydropower. Look, they don't all have to be jokes.
How about that? Good for you. Good for you, Prime Minister. Number 2.
We drive on the left side of the road, like the British and Lindsay Lohan.
And the number one reason you should visit New Zealand.
Unlike most of the world, we still like Americans.
There you go.
We've moved from tragedy to farce. Let's move on to scandal. In August 2007, Counterpunch published a piece by David Rosen called America's Top 10 Sex Scandals. He began by dashing off a list of a dozen recent sex scandals by American politicians, most of them Bible-thumping moral majority-type Republicans, by the way. There was David Vitter, Randall L. Tobias, Mark Fowley, Don Sherwood, the Reverend Ted Haggard, Bob Allen, Dan Burton, Joe Scarborough, Gary Condit, Ken Calvert, and Robert Livingston. There was, of course, Bill Clinton, enjoying some extramarital hanky-panky provided by Ms. Monica Lewinsky. Clinton's immorality was condemned by Republican Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich, who at the time was enjoying the very same, provided by Gingrich campaign worker Ann Manning. Sidebar comment, Rosen's compendium of sleaze was published just weeks before it was discovered that Republican Senator Larry Craig had been arrested for alleged lewd behavior in a restroom of the Minneapolis-St. Paul airport. Thus the exculpatory phrase, wide stance, entered the American vocabulary. Ironically, I think Craig would have been found not guilty of the charge had the case come to court. Unfortunately, Craig panicked and pled guilty to a lesser charge, disorderly conduct. And if you get busted, remember to say, and say only, those six magic words, I wish to call my lawyer. Anyway, after listing a dozen, Rosen then says that all these scandals are just the junior varsity. He then discusses the top really big political sex scandals. I'll read five of them. Sex scandal number 10, George W. Bush. While many are aware of Bush's dubious participation in the National Guard and his alcohol and cocaine problems, little attention has been paid to the alleged sex scandals that took place while he was Texas governor. He had been the subject of two sex scandals that were successfully dismissed as crank complaints, effectively sweeping them under the proverbial rug. The first involved a criminal complaint and lawsuit of rape by Margie Schrödinger that took place in 2000, and who later allegedly committed suicide. The second was an accusation by Tammy Phillips, a former stripper, of having an affair with Bush that ended in 1999, and she later disappeared. Sex scandal number 7, Strom Thurmond. As a lustful lad, Thurmond had a sexual liaison with his family's African-American maid, Carrie Butler. One unanswered question is whether Ms. Butler was a consenting partner or the victim of rape. Another is her age at the time of the sexual engagement, whether she was 15 or 16 years, and whether the future senator and committed racist was, legally, a pedophile. Further complicating Thurmond's darker past is the revelation that, genetically, he and the Reverend Al Sharpton share the same family line. Sex scandal number 6, James Buchanan. Buchanan appears to be America's only gay president. Buchanan lived for many years with William Rufus King, an Alabama senator. The two men were considered inseparable and were the butt of much mockery. Andrew Jackson dubbed King Miss Nancy. And Aaron Brown, writing to Mrs. James K. Polk, referred to King as Buchanan's better half, his wife, and Aunt Fancy, rigged out in her best clothes. The only question for his contemporaries was whether or not Buchanan's infatuation with King rose to the level of a scandal. Sex scandal number 5, John F. Kennedy. Kennedy's lovers included Marilyn Monroe and Angie Dickinson, Inga Arvad, a Danish journalist, the stripper Blaze Starr, Judith Exner Campbell, who was also mistress to mob boss Sam Giancana, and White House secretaries Priscilla Wyer and Jill Cowan, who were referred to as Fiddle and Faddle. Like the affairs of Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Dwight D. Eisenhower, Kennedy's extramarital liaisons were effectively suppressed. Which brings us to sex scandal number 1, Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson's relation with Sally Hemings the African-American slave who is his wife's half-sister and with whom he had 6 children, makes this America's most scandalous sex scandal. Yes, Sally Hemings and Mrs. Jefferson shared not only a main squeeze, but also a father. 4 of the children that Hemings had with Jefferson survived to adulthood. All appeared to be white in complexion, and Jefferson set them all free. Ironically, Hemings was not freed by Jefferson, but given her time. That is a form of unofficial freedom so she could live in Virginia. Given her time by Jefferson's daughter, Martha Randolph. Further proof that, since forever, Washington, D.C. was just a little Peyton place, and its inhabitants were all Harper Valley hypocrites.
Johnson, you're wearing your dress is way too high. It's reported you've been drinking and are running around with men and going wild. And we don't believe you ought to be bringing up your little girl this way. And it was signed by the secretary, Harper Valley PTA. Surprised when Mrs. Johnson wore her mini skirt into the room. And as she walked up to the blackboard, I can still recall the words she had to say. She said, I'd like to address this meeting of the Harper Valley PTA. Well, there's Bobby Taylor sitting there, and 7 times he's asked me for a date. Sure seems to use a lot of ice whenever he's away. And Mr. Baker, can you tell us why your secretary had to leave this town? And shouldn't Gwyneth Jones be told to keep her window shades off or completely down?
Incidentally, the William Tell Overture we heard earlier was performed by Spike Jones, and the song we just heard, Harper Valley PTA, was a big pop and country hit of 1968, sung by Gene C. Reilly. I should probably gloss the reference. Peyton Place is the title of a racy potboiler of a novel, that is, by 1956 standards, written by an obscure American named Grace Metalius. Peyton Place was the name of a fictional small New England town, likely in New Hampshire. As one book critic put it, hypocrisy, social inequities, and class privilege are recurring themes in a tale that includes incest, abortion, adultery, lust, and murder. Quote, unquote. Something for everybody, and not unlike Washington, D.C. today. The following top 10 list drives me to the height of ambivalence. The top 10 combat rifles, which I stumbled across just the other day. Therefore, I commend it to your attention. This has appeared on several cable networks. We'll focus on the grand winner of this competition, but this episode begins with a recap of the 9 runners-up.
Before we find out what the number 1 combat rifle is, let's run down the top 10 list. At 10, it's the Combat Kid. The M14 has been around for 40 years, but it's still doing a job. At 9, the weapon Hitler called the Storm Rifle, the German Sturmgewehr. Number 8, the Springfield 03, nicknamed the Silent Death. It was lethally accurate. 7th spot goes to the Steyr AUG, space-age looks and a space-age design. At number 6, it's the Mauser 98K, Hitler's favorite rifle. At 5, the big-hitting Belgian battle rifle, the FN-FAL. 4th in our list, it's the weapon that helped America win World War II, the M1 Garand. At number 3, the Lee Enfield SMLE, a true British classic. And at number 2, it's the rifle that has seen the American GI through Vietnam and into the 21st century, the M16. And finally, at number 1, the best of the best, a rifle which has become an icon of the 20th century as both a symbol of freedom and oppression.
Kalashnikov, AK-47. Type, semi or fully automatic assault rifle. Country of origin, Soviet Union. Caliber, 7.62 by 39 millimeter. Cartridge capacity, 30 rounds. Muzzle velocity, 2,329 feet per second. Rate of fire, 600 rounds per minute.
If I had to go to a planet, an unknown planet, and I was allowed to take one firearm, it would be an AK-47. When Western civilization melts down, I want an AK-47.
The AK-47 is the lord of war. It probably caused the most death of any single weapon system produced ever.
When you feel that click, you know you got 30 rounds of rock and roll.
With over 50 million built worldwide, the AK-47 is a firearms legend. Its designer was Mikhail Kalashnikov. A Soviet tank sergeant, he devised the weapon while recovering from wounds sustained on the Eastern Front in World War II.
Mikhail Kalashnikov was an inveterate tanker. He's self-described as the kind of guy who couldn't look at a door lock without wanting to take it apart and put it back together.
As he's recuperating in hospital, he comes up with the idea for a self-loading rifle. And in 1947, it is approved as the new small arm for the Russian infantry, hence its designation AK-47, automatic Kalashnikov 1947 pattern.
Built on the same principles as the German Sturmgewehr, it chambered an intermediate round and was built from stamped parts. Easy to produce and relatively cheap, the AK-47 looked clumsy, but when tested, it was supremely reliable, and to soldiers, that reliability meant something.
What can you do to an AK-47 to make it stop firing? Not a whole lot. Maybe drive over with a tank.
The Kalashnikov had proved itself. Through the latter part of the 20th century, it could be heard spitting out shells on every corner of the world. In Afghanistan, Soviet troops and the Mujahideen went toe-to-toe with AK-47s. And in guerrilla wars across Africa, the clatter of the AK has resounded. As a result, it has become more than a weapon. It has become an icon.
If there's a single thing that represents the heyday of Soviet revolutionary expansionism, it is the AK-47. It becomes, next to Che Guevara's image on the high school student's t-shirt, the iconic image of the 1960s and 70s. It is everywhere. It's on the flag of a country, of Mozambique, because it was so central in their revolution.
And so Americans have grown up seeing the AK-47 as the bad guy's gun. People don't like the looks of the AK. It's an ugly gun. You can't picture John Wayne carrying an AK-47. Would he carry one? probably he was a practical man.
The AK-47 is an indestructible, universal killing machine. Hardly surprising, then, that it scores top marks for combat effectiveness. Handling is excellent. Service length is excellent. Innovation is excellent. Accuracy is average, but the Kalashnikov compensates for this with its ability to unleash a lethal wall of lead.
Can you believe that voiceover narrator? Sounds like they borrowed him from the wide world of sports. I mean, I can understand appreciating an elegantly designed piece of machinery, a wristwatch, a racing bicycle, a gun for sure. But with a military rifle, which is designed mainly for putting holes in people, I think that at least a little ambivalence would not be entirely out of place. But here's the breathless narrator.
The AK-47 is an indestructible, universal killing machine. Hardly surprising, then, that it scores top marks for combat effectiveness. Handling is excellent. Service length is excellent.
Okay. A curious omission in that clip was Iraq. Iraq is awash in AK-47s. They are, or were, manufactured in Iraq under license from the Russian authorities. So ubiquitous is the AK there that the American occupying forces didn't even try to confiscate them. One of the few smart moves Rumsfeld's boys made. They allowed every family to keep one Kalashnikov. Except in a few areas that the occupiers suspected especially hated Americans, such as the city of Fallujah. Two Kalashnikovs in your house, and you're off to Abu Ghraib. One we're willing to overlook. Well, on that upbeat note, I bid you a fond adieu. New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. The opinions expressed here are my own, and if the station manager doesn't like them, I have 8mm movies of him and Mrs. Johnson doing things that I believe were illegal in Hartford County when she was kind enough to do them for him. No, just kidding. For more information, or to send an angry email, see our webpage, http://newworldnotes.blogspot.com. I'll get my non-carborundum, and please tune in again next week. And again, about our station manager, Conrad Ramsey. In truth, we all love him. Ciao.